Welcome to Watchmen on the Wall, a daily outreach of Southwest Radio Ministries and SWRC.com. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. Today, archaeologist Abigail Van Hus reveals the mountain of curses that are found in the Holy Land. Faithful friends, our effort to have 500 monthly supporters join the work here at Southwest Radio Ministries is officially underway, and I'm so excited to report that as of today, we have individuals and families that have committed to supporting SWRC and Watchmen on the Wall on a monthly basis. Will you join these faithful friends with your monthly gift? Visit SWRC.com and click on Donate Now, or just call 1-800-652-1144. Please, friends, be one of the faithful 500 this month. Your recurring monthly gift, it helps us continue this kingdom-sized mission every single day. 1-800-652-1144. In July, we hosted our first ever biblically grounded archaeology conference. One of the speakers was archaeologist Abigail Van Hus. Today, we're going to listen to her fascinating presentation on the Mountain of Curses.
We're talking about Joshua's altar on Mount Ebal. And this may not be one of the most well-known Bible stories, but it's certainly an important one because this is the formation of the Israelite nation. This is the Israelites. They've come out of Egypt. They've wandered in the wilderness. They have crossed over the Jordan. They've conquered Jericho. They've conquered Ai. Now they're going to have a ceremony to form their new nation. So Moses commanded the people that same day, saying, these shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people when you've crossed over the Jordan, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. And these shall stand on Mount Ebal to curse Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. So we have half of the tribes on one mountain, so we can see here how this looks. So Mount Gerizim, they're on the left, Mount Ebal on the right, and then in the valley in the middle is the ancient city of Shechem, which shows up throughout the Old Testament. And so we have, this is the setup, half of the tribes on Mount Gerizim, and this is the Mountain of Blessings, half the tribes on Mount Ebal, this is the Mountain of Curses, and they're going to speak these blessings and curses back and forth from these two mountains. And basically what this ceremony is it is that they're recounting to God, we understand the terms of this covenant we're making. We understand that if we obey you, you're going to bless us. If we disobey you, you're going to curse us. So, and then it says, therefore it shall be when you have crossed over the Jordan that on Mount Ebal you shall set up these stones. And he's talking about stones that they're supposed to write the law on, which I commanded you today, and you shall whitewash them with lime. Or plaster. And there you shall build an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not use an iron tool on them. You shall build them with whole stones. You shall build with whole stones the altar of the Lord your God and offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God. You shall offer peace offerings and shall eat there and rejoice before the Lord your God. And you shall write very plainly on the stones all the words of this law. So we see that they're instructed. There's going to be an altar. There's going to be stones set up. These are things that are going to be constructed on Mount Ebal, and that's important to us as archaeologists because if there's something tangible constructed, this isn't just people standing on the mountains anymore. I mean, they are. We're not going to find evidence of that, but if they're building something, that's something that we could find evidence of. And then in Joshua, we find out that they did what Moses said. Now Joshua built an altar to the Lord God of Israel in Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses. An altar of whole stones over which no man has wielded an iron tool, and they offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And there in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Okay, so if we were to go and look for Joshua's altar, I looked through the Bible for like, what would we look for? What criteria, if we were to find an altar on Mount Ebal, how would we know it's Joshua's altar? And so, of course, the first criteria is that it has to be on Mount Ebal. It's very specific that they're to build this altar on Mount Ebal. It's to be made of whole stones rather than of stones that are chiseled into nice blocks. It's very specific about that. This didn't show up, the next one didn't show up in the passages that I just read, but it can't have stairs to get up onto it. That's from Exodus 20, where it explains that you shouldn't have stairs going up to your altar, because as the priest is going up and he's climbing stairs, he might get exposed indecently. And so you can't have stairs. So either the altar has to be low, so that you don't have to climb up, or there has to be some other way of getting to the top and not stairs. And then there's some things I put in the category of potential evidence. These are things that might have survived. We might find evidence, but may not have survived. But you could find stones coated with plaster, because that's a very specific thing, is that they coated these stones with plaster and they wrote the law on them. You could find remains of offerings, because that's the whole point, is they're going to sacrifice offerings there on Mount Ebal. You could find evidence of a communal meal, because they're doing peace offerings there. And what the peace offering is it's almost like a potluck. It's a shared meal. Part of it you sacrifice to God, so God gets part. The priest gets part, and then you get part, and you sit with your family and you eat. And so there's this communal meal going on there at Mount Ebal. And then you might find evidence of literacy, because they're writing the law on stones. And so we know that biblically they were literate. And so we might find evidence of literacy. And then there's a key requirement, because you could get all of this stuff that lines up and it looks really good, but if it doesn't date to the time of Joshua, then it can't be Joshua's altar. And that's where it gets tricky, because first we have to figure out, when did Joshua live? When was Joshua there at Mount Ebal? And then you have to figure out what's the dating of any structure that you find on Mount Ebal. So you have to get the two, both of them figured out, and get them to line up. In the 1880s, Condor and Kitchener, they surveyed the whole region. They did an amazing survey. They were on horseback, I think, and just like looking at the land and looking for biblical sites. And so as part of the survey, they surveyed Mount Ebal, and they even did a little excavation on the summit of the mountain. And they did not find any evidence of Joshua's altar. And what they said, and here just to orient you, I've got, it's probably a little hard to see with all the colors, but Mount Gerizim down there on the bottom, Mount Ebal up on the top, Shechem I have marked down in the valley in the center. And then they found this site called Amad ad-Din that's on the slopes of Mount Ebal facing Mount Gerizim. And they didn't find archaeological evidence there, but they said, and there was like an outcropping of rocks. And they said, well, if Joshua's altar was anywhere, this is probably where it would have been. They liked the location because they said, well, it faces Mount Gerizim, and so that makes sense that, it would be part of the ceremony and it would be right there. And so they didn't find any evidence, but they just said, this is probably the best candidate we've got. Now, in the 1980s, Dr. Adam Zertal came along, and he's a secular Israeli archaeologist from Haifa University. And he did not believe the Bible was true. He did not believe that Joshua ever existed. But he was doing an archaeological survey of the Manasseh Hill Country. He was just going around looking for all the sites in the region. And that he has passed away since then, but his survey is still ongoing. And I got to be part of it. There I am with part of the team. And we would just go out and we would all spread out in a line and just walk and look at the ground and look for pottery, look for walls, look for anything. And so that was a lot of fun being part of his survey team. We were actually surveying the hill next to Mount Ebal so we could look over and see Mount Ebal from there. But Zertal discovered and excavated a site called El Bernat A. And that's to differentiate it from El Bernat B, which is a nearby site, which is totally unrelated. But he discovered this site on the eastern slopes of Mount Ebal. So to see it on the map, it's way up there on the top. So it's on kind of the back side of Mount Ebal. It's not facing Mount Gerizim, but it's on the back side. And so that's not where anybody thought to look for Joshua's altar. You wouldn't necessarily expect it to be where you can't even see it from where they held the ceremony of blessings and cursings. I don't think that disqualifies the site, because the Bible doesn't say that it was visible from the ceremony. It just says that it's on Mount Ebal. And this is what he excavated. This is kind of the footprint and, footprint in a more literal sense, because you can see it's kind of shaped like a footprint. And Adam Zertal discovered a number of these sites shaped like footprints. They're low stone walls that enclose a site. And he had a theory about these, and it's kind of too much to get into right now, but he thought that they were the Gilgalim, the sites named Gilgal, because in the Bible we see that there are multiple, that the Israelites camp at Gilgal, but Gilgal seems to move. And so he had this theory that God said, you know, wherever you place the sole of your foot, I'm going to give you that land. And so he thinks that they built these enclosures in the shape of footprints as a reminder of that promise. But inside this enclosure, there's actually like a smaller enclosure within the big enclosure. So we can see here. And then kind of at the heart of that is this structure. And this is an altar. Almost certainly people have argued that it might not be, but I think that the latest consensus is that it is indeed an altar. And here's a picture of it. So you can see built of field stones. There's the main structure, and then it has these courtyards, and up the center is a ramp that leads to the top. And if we look at it, a schematic drawing, you can kind of see that there's two strata, two time periods at the site. And I've done the earlier time period in green, the later time period in black. So in the earlier time period, we actually see a smaller round altar that was built there. And this is just it's 2 meters across, about 6 feet. And then there are all of these stone rings all over the place, all surrounding it. And then later on, somebody came back, they came to this site, and right over top of it, they built this big structure with the courtyards and the ramp and everything. So two time periods, two structures, but both of them altars. If we were to look at a cross section, if we were to cut the altar right through that line and look at it from the side, we would see the three walls there and then these layers that fill it. And so you can see the way they slope. It looks like someone stood here on wall 16 and dumped stuff in, and it kind of rolled down. So Adam Zertal believed that what happened is that when they built this, they filled it up, and this isn't just any material. This is layer upon layer of ash and bone, and it's bones of sheep and goats and cattle. So he thought that they filled it up with the remains of sacrifices. So yesterday, Dr. Stripling, if you were here, he talked about a favisa at Shiloh. A favisa is a sacred dump pile, stuff that's been offered. And so the idea here is that within the altar itself is a favisa, is the remains of previous sacrifices that they've put in the altar. And then they sealed the top with stone. Oops, went the wrong way. They sealed the top with this layer, thick layer of stones, so that then you could actually stand on top. So the bones that they found in there, 65% sheep and goats, 21% cattle, 10% fallow deer, and 4% small mammals. So the vast majority of these bones are sacrificial animals according to the Mosaic law, the sheep and goats and cattle. The fallow deer are a very interesting thing, and I'll address that a little bit later. The small mammals, I think those can be accounted for as just field animals that are running around the site anyway and got mixed in. I don't think that those would be part of the sacrifices. It's a low percentage, and I think it's just the animals that live there naturally. All right, so I'm going to go through because I want to look at the site that Adam Zertal excavated with the altars and go through my list of criteria and see, does this site qualify? And that's what I did for my master's thesis, and as I just went through the criteria, and I wanted to see, does it work? And this is what I have in my book. It's out on the table, too, if you're interested in seeing it all written out and in more detail than I can get in today. But today I'm going to go through these criteria, and we'll see how it lines up. So first, it has to be on Mount Ebal. That one's pretty straightforward, and it is. It's on the back side, but it is indeed on Mount Ebal. It's kind of on a lower step, which is interesting because the word that's used in the Hebrew actually means in Mount Ebal, as opposed to on. And there's been some question, like, why did they use that term? And it could be like being down in that step qualifies as more tucked away in Mount Ebal. I don't know, but I thought that was interesting. The next one is that it needs to be made of whole stones. It can't be chiseled stones. They weren't supposed to use any iron tool on it. And of course, we see that both the earlier small round altar and the big rectangular one, both are made of field stones. They are just piled and, you know, made to fit, but they're not chiseled. So in that sense, it qualifies. Either one qualifies in that sense. There can't be stairs to get up on top of it. That's the next qualification according to Exodus. And again, we see, of course, we can't see the round one in this picture, but it's low enough. I don't think you would have needed stairs, and it's small enough that you don't really need to get on top of it. You can stand next to it. And then the large rectangular altar has the ramp going up the center. So no stairs. So both altars qualify in that sense. And then potential evidence, things that we could find. And the first one is stones coated with plaster and hopefully with words written on them. That would be even better. And we don't find stones coated with plaster per se, but what Adam Zertal did find, he says, in the middle of the northern part of the fill, he's talking about the fill of the large rectangular altar. He says, in the northern part of the fill, some 20 pieces of white plaster, about 3 centimeters thick, were neatly arranged in layers. These plaster chunks must have originated in stratum 2. That's the earlier stratum, the older one. And similar traces of plaster were found in area B in both strata. To the best of my knowledge, no plaster of any sort has been recovered from any other Iron One sites. Now, since then, I think some plaster has been found maybe at some Iron Age sites, but it's certainly rare. And so my thought on this is, and it's speculative, but I think that if they had stones coated in plaster with the law of God written on them, and maybe it started to deteriorate and chunks of plaster were falling off, those could be counted as sacred. And so when they're making this favisa within the altar, collecting the sacred trash, the bones of sacrificial animals and all of this, that they could have laid those pieces of plaster in there as part of this sacred collection. And so, like I said, it's speculative, but the plaster chunks actually have been sent for testing. They're working on it. I haven't heard any results. I would love to find out if they find any traces of writing on them, but that's too early to say yet. Our next criteria is that you have to have remains of offerings, or you might find them. And of course, we do in the form of, well, in multiple forms. And one thing that's interesting is in the first period of occupation, we have all these stone rings all around the altar. And those are known archaeologically as offering rings. You would make a little ring of stones and you put your offering in it. And so what Adam Zertal found in those rings, different things, but a lot of jewelry, gold and silver earrings, which as Dr. Striplane mentioned yesterday, you don't normally find those in an archaeological site. People don't lose their gold and their silver. And so when we see that, we know it was left there purposely as an offering. And then also in those rings, he found some interesting little handmade pottery vessels. And we see these at temples in that period, and we call them votive vessels. And they're made specifically to be brought as offerings. And so he found those kind of things in those rings, so that's, I think, evidence of offerings. And then, of course, we have the bones, 2,862 of them was what they found at the site. And again, those numbers, 65% sheep and goat, 21% cattle. The fallow deer, I think, fit the next point on my list of criteria, and that's evidence of a communal meal. And the reason that I think that is based on Deuteronomy 12. It says, however, you may slaughter and eat meat within all your gates, whatever your heart desires, according to the blessing of the Lord your God, which he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, of the gazelle and the deer alike. And so this is talking about a time, he's looking forward to a time when the Israelites are going to be settled in the land, in their promised land. They're going to have homes, and they're going to, in the context, it's talking about that the fact that they're going to be far away. Some of them are going to be far away from the temple. And so they might not be able to come on a regular basis. They're going to come for the big feasts to the temple. But but on a regular basis, they're going to want to eat meat, and so they can't be sacrificing at the temple all the time. And he says, no, it's okay. You can eat meat within your homes, and you can eat gazelle and deer. And so what I think is going on, these Israelites, they're not in their homes yet. They've only just arrived in the promised land. They're all camping in tents. They're all together as a unit. But they've been called together to Mount Ebal for this sacrifice and for this communal meal. And so I think what's going on is that they are following this, that they're allowed to eat gazelle and deer. And so they're supplementing. They're doing a big potluck. Of course, they're doing the sacrifices and eating that, but I think they're supplementing with these fallow deer, because what we find at the sites, we don't find complete skeletons, which you would think you would find if they're killing the animals right there on the site and sacrificing them. Instead, we're finding like the limbs, the meaty portions, as if they're hunting them somewhere else, butchering them, and then bringing in the meat to eat there at Mount Ebal. So that's what I think is going on with the fallow deer. We might find evidence of literacy, because we read in the Bible that these people at Mount Ebal are literate. They're writing on the stones, and if only Joshua is literate, why would he write on stones for the people to see if they can't read it, right? So we assume that a large portion of these people are literate according to the text. And we found a very interesting set of tools at the site. Each one is a little bit different. Some of them have chisel ends, some of them have awl ends, some of them have blades. And I think that this could be a set of writing tools, like maybe a workman set with all the different tips options. And they could be workman's tools for other things. But given the fact that the altar is not made of chiseled stones, they're not using their chisels to chisel stones to build there, and I think that there's a possibility that these could be epigrapher's tools for writing there at the site. And then other signs of literacy, we find these handles. I was actually just talking to Nikki about them. And I think that they mean something. And they have these are all handles of jars, and they have the puncture marks in them, and some of them have slashes. Some of them even make cute little faces. And I don't know what they mean. I would love for somebody to figure that out, but I think they mean something. They could mean something about the contents of the jar. They could mean something about who made the jar. They could mean something about where it came from. Maybe if different tribes are bringing in their offerings in jars, maybe they're marking them that way. I don't know. But I think that they're evidence of literacy in the fact that they mean something, that somebody knows what they mean. And then Adam Zertal found a six-sided seal or die. Up here you can see all the sides, each one is different. And so obviously you could roll that and it's going to mean something. And there's even some thought that this could be part of the Urim and Thummim that the priest used to communicate with God and get an answer. We don't quite know what the Urim and Thummim were. There's a lot of different ideas. But one is that it was something like this, where you had a pair of dice that you would roll. And they even found next to this a chalice with the bottom cut out that would make a dice roller. So that was interesting. Scarabs, of course, you all heard all about scarabs yesterday. Scarabs are a sign of literacy because those all have a different meaning. And when you stamp that to create a seal on a letter or something, when the person gets it and they're going to open the letter, they know it's from you because that's your seal. So that's, again, a sign of literacy. One even has the cartouche, the name of Thutmose III on it. It's a little small and hard to see, but that's right there. And then the lead tablet, this was not part of Adam Zertal's excavation. He did not find that. Our team actually found that. We went to Mount Ebal a few years ago in 2019, and we decided to go through the trash at Mount Ebal. What Adam Zertal had dug up and he left in a trash pile, we went through it because we have better technology now. We have wet sifting, which he did not have when he excavated in the 1980s. And so we went through his trash pile in order to see what he missed, and that was one of the things that we found. We found this tablet, and it's made of lead, very thin, folded in half. We couldn't get it open, and so we sent it to Prague, where they were able to scan it, and the team of epigraphers that worked on it and published the article gave us this translation. You are cursed by the God Yahweh, cursed. You will die, cursed. Cursed you will surely die. Cursed you are by Yahweh, cursed. And so that's a lot of curses. But to me, it's reminiscent of this passage in Deuteronomy 28. I highlighted some terms in there. But it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I commanded you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land, the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. And who's doing these curses? The Lord, Yahweh. That's Yahweh. The Lord will send on you cursing, confusion, and rebuke in all that you set your hand to do until you are destroyed and perished quickly because of the wickedness of your doings in which you have forsaken me. The Lord, Yahweh, will make the plague cling to you until he has consumed you from the land which you are going to possess. The Lord, that's Yahweh, will strike you with consumption, with fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with the sword, with scorching, and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish. Your carcass shall be food for all the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth. So what's going to happen? You're going to die. So look back at the tablet. You are cursed. By whom? By the God Yahweh. And what's going to happen? You will die.
We've been listening to a portion of Abigail Van Hus's presentation on the Mountain of Curses, first given at our Biblically Grounded conference held this past July. The entire conference, 12 presentations from 6 of the world's leading voices on biblical archaeology, is now available. Step back into history and see how archaeology confirms God's Word. This powerful DVD collection captures the live presentations from the 2025 Biblically Grounded Archaeology Experience, a Christ-centered weekend where top Bible scholars, archaeologists, and researchers revealed the latest discoveries that bring Scripture to life. And now you can order the entire conference on DVD. Order the complete DVD set today. Call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. Or you can just order online. Visit swrc.com and order the Biblically Grounded Archaeology Experience DVD collection. Perfect for personal study, small groups, or church libraries. The Biblically Grounded Archaeology Experience DVD collection set will deepen your faith and equip you to share how archaeology continues to confirm the truth of the Bible. 1-800-652-1144. Watchmen on the Wall is a production of Southwest Radio Ministries and is supported by faithful friends like you. To learn more, visit our website, swrc.com.